Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, a great day to remember the good old days when people said that person is liberal, or he's liberal-minded, or he's a liberal spirit, or he's a liberal soul. It often meant open-minded, somebody who was willing to weigh all sides and to consider new ideas and to try to be even-handed and fair. Remember that? Not so much anymore. What it means to be liberal in today's world is to have a totalitarian mindset where the other side, anyone who dares to disagree with you, has to be cast into utter and outer darkness and totally disregarded. Where do you see that? You see that particularly with the use and misuse of science. And yes, this is our Science and Culture Hour with Discovery Institute on the Michael Medved Show. We're doing a live broadcast with Discovery Institute and two of my very good friends from Discovery, Stephen Meyer, who is director of the Center for Science and Culture, and David Klinghoffer, who is also a prodigious and best-selling author and is a senior fellow at Discovery Institute. And what we're talking about is the use and misuse of science to close rather than to open minds. 1-800-955-1776 is our phone number. That's particularly notable with a guy named Al Gore, a Nobel Prize laureate. Yeah, really he is, who was, like most Nobel Prize winners, he was on the Jimmy Kimmel Show last night, and we will play some of that for consideration. But first of all, there's so many examples of a closed-minded attitude toward science and culture from the left. Stephen Meyer, you've seen that firsthand with some of the reaction to your best-selling book, and it's been a New York Times bestseller. It's called Darwin's Doubt. What was it about your book that provoked the kind of ferocious response from some people on the left?
Well, it's the issue of biological origins has been a contentious scientific issue for a long time, but it's a scientific issue that also has larger philosophical or worldview implications. And so a lot of times I think scientists are unable to separate their own worldview or personal philosophy from the scientific evidence. I have a debating partner, Michael Ruse, a friendly Darwinist on the other side of the controversy, who's written an important book in which he explains that Darwinian evolution has functioned as a kind of secular religion for many scientists, and when you challenge the Darwinian theory on the basis of the evidence, many scientists react as if their worldview or religion is being challenged, and they react very emotionally as a result.
David Klinghoffer, you've written about some of the controversy regarding Stephen's book and the response to Stephen's book,
Yeah. And
you have a lot of experience with the world of book reviews because you were literary editor of the National Review for many years and then a senior editor at National Review. You're the author of 6 books yourself, and your books have been very well reviewed, but then again, your last book, which you wrote with Joe Lieberman, senator from Connecticut, former senator now, was about the Sabbath, which is just not as intensely controversial a subject for most people as what Stephen is talking about, which is the origins of life. What did you notice in terms of the response to our friend Stephen's book?
Yeah, it's a fascinating response. But it's book reviewing 101, and I sent in soliciting book reviews for many years at National Review, I would send reviews back if they didn't say what was in the book. If they didn't say what the author of the book says. And the really amazing thing about most of the reviews of Darwin's Doubt has been the sort of passive-aggressive refusal to engage or even say what Steve's thesis is and to wrestle with the arguments. And it's amazing. I've never seen for all the book reviews I've read in the course of my professional life, I've never seen anything quite like this.
Well, again, I've spoken to people who have gotten the idea from media that what your book is about Stephen, is the idea that the Earth is just 6,000 years old and dinosaurs coexisted with human beings and it was all like Fred Flintstone and Dino. You want to explain to people that that's not what your book is about?
Well, I start by talking about an event that happened a lot longer ago than 6,000 years. The Cambrian explosion is something that occurred 530 million years ago.
And by the way, nobody doubts that it occurred. The fossil record is pretty clear.
No, it's very clear. And the two leading Cambrian experts who also came out with a book on the Cambrian explosion this year, James Valentine of the University of California, Berkeley, and Doug Irwin of the Smithsonian Institution, argue that the convincingly that the explosion was real. It's not an artifact of incomplete sampling of the fossil record or incomplete preservation of those missing ancestral forms. It's a real event, and it has to be reckoned with.
Okay, so if it has to be reckoned with, and your book is an attempt to do that, and David, you say you've never seen anything quite like the response to Stephen's book. How did most reviewers deal with it? You break down. You have a piece people can read it on our website.
So, there were reviews that came out even before the book was published. So. In the best
I ought to try that with some movies, actually. Yeah. Save me a lot of time.
The best or the worst of those, I think, was by a guy who's sort of the paladin of Darwin defenders, Jerry Coyne at the University of Chicago, who writes a blog called Why Evolution is True. So you would think that if anyone, I mean, he's sort of the American Dawkins, so if anyone should be obliged to respond to Steve, it should be Coyne. But he's simply refused to read the book. Or debate, or anything like that. And his review of the book that came out before it was published was five words. Yes, baby Jesus made the phyla, which is the name for the categories of animals that arose in the Cambrian explosion. So that was his summary of the book. That's, you know, which is obviously completely false.
Well, you're not trying to introduce that it's false that baby Jesus made the phyla, right?
No, I'm saying
no. That's as a characterization. To the very best of my knowledge, I don't think you discuss baby Jesus in your book.
Baby Jesus did make it.
No
footnotes. To,
right now,
crushes or anything.
But it's extraordinary. By the way, we've invited Jerry Coyne onto our show to talk to me, to debate Stephen, to participate. What do you think the response has been?
He won't do it. He absolutely will not. He won't even read the book. But so what he does is kicks off the review to people who claim to have read it, like this fellow Nick Matsky, who was the very first review that came out and read the book supposedly and wrote an almost 10,000-word review in 24 hours. So claiming to have read the book, but it's a stretch to believe that anyone could do that in 24 hours and write a 10,000-word review.
Well, it's a page-turner. You want to keep reading. But it is, it's a big book to write a long review in just 24 hours. So, Stephen, somehow your book got out. It's made an impact on the culture already. People are talking about it. People are finding it. Certainly it's been a terrifically successful book. How did that happen, given the pretty strong indication in terms of the establishment media to sort of shut the door and to get people not even to consider your arguments?
Well, my own sense as an author is that the effort was counterproductive, that some of these non-reviews or I have a friend, a statistician, who says you have a bimodal distribution on Amazon. It's the five stars and the one stars. But the one stars are often, you know, they resort to potty talk and they're profane. One guy says the book's a steaming pile of pseudoscience. Somebody else says it's mendacious intellectual pornography. And, you know, that kind of rhetorical excess, I think, makes people curious. And whatever it is, it's very bad, and I want to find out about it. So
this is—I don't know if you know that the late Norman Mailer. There's a new, brand new, big biography of Mailer, and it recalls one of the episodes in his career. He had a very successful first novel, *The Naked and the Dead*, and then his second novel was called *The Deer Park*, which is unreadable. It is a steaming pile of, and it got such terrible reviews, and no one was buying it. They were trying to give it away. It was kind of like healthcare.gov. It just wasn't working. And so Mailer took out a full-page ad in the Village Voice that featured all of the most negative quotes about his book. This is the worst book I've ever read. And all of a sudden it took off. Yeah. It became, so maybe that's a strategy here.
Our friend David Berlinski says that these negative reviews are self-discrediting. They're so extreme and they're content-free that it makes people curious as to what the book is actually about.
To find out what the book is actually about, you can go to our website, to michaelmedved.com. Click on the Science and Culture banner. You can also sign up for Evolution News and Views, which is a weekly roundup. You can subscribe to Nota Bene, which is a weekly roundup of Evolution News and Views, which is a website maintained by our friend David Klinghoffer. You can do all of that by clicking on the Science and Culture banner. When we come back, one of the other areas in which science, so-called, is used to close minds, not open them, obviously has to do not only with the debate about the origins of life, but ongoing debates about climate change. Al Gore, some amazing scientific discoveries he's just announced. We'll get to that on the MedVet Show.
1-800-955-1776. The Michael MedVet Show.
After the hour on the Michael Medved Show, broadcasting live with a whole bunch of our good friends from Discovery Institute, folks who came out for this live broadcast. If, by the way, you are in the San Diego area and you want to participate in a live broadcast tomorrow, there is another chance for a free live broadcast of the show from noon to 3 San Diego time at La Costa, at the Omni Resort at La Costa, as part of the La Costa Film Festival. And we're going to be broadcasting live tomorrow. You can go to our website and sign up for that. And you can go to our website and click on the Science and Culture banner and find out all about the great work of the Discovery Institute. Now, we had a member of the audience who will remain nameless who came up moments ago, Stephen Meyer, and said, well, we're talking about your book and the controversial message of your book. What is the controversial message of Darwin's Doubt? And I said, well, I guess he mentioned the Cambrian explosion. Everybody knows the Cambrian explosion. There, okay, the message.
You bet. Darwin's Doubt is the story of a doubt that Darwin had about his own theory, which concerned an event in the history of life known as the Cambrian explosion. And the Cambrian explosion is the geologically abrupt or sudden appearance of the major groups of animal forms in the fossil record. And the book explains that mystery that was puzzling to Darwin has grown up to be a much more profound mystery, one that is creating a crisis in evolutionary biology for two reasons. One, the missing ancestral fossils of these animals that first appear so suddenly have not turned up, and yet more Cambrian animals have turned up, making the explosion more explosive. But secondly, and more importantly, it's even more mysterious because of everything we've learned about what it takes to build an animal, the importance of digital code in the DNA molecule and other forms of genetic information, of sophisticated circuitry that's involved in the development of animals from embryo to adult form. And I argue in the book that not only are these things which are so difficult to explain from a materialistic Darwinian point of view puzzling, but these things like digital code and circuitry are actually positive indicators of the role of a purpose of intelligence in the history of life. What we know from experience is that it takes a mind or an intelligence to generate information, to generate circuitry. And since those things are essential to the origin of these animal forms, the Cambrian explosion is an explosion of information, after all. What we're actually looking at is evidence of designing intelligence having played a role in the history of life.
So clearly there was a federal government tech surge some millions of years ago that created a lot of new life forms all of a sudden. But that actually is quite relevant to this, because obviously creating an animal is, by large margins of advantage, much more complicated to do from an information standpoint than rewriting a bunch of code for the government website.
Animals are hierarchically organized systems of information and information processing, and we really because of the advances in modern high-tech digital computing, are at a point in our own development as scientists able to really appreciate what's going on inside life, and the ability now to, in a sense, reverse engineer an animal and to say, not that we can actually build one, but we can at least understand the necessary conditions of building an animal. We know from experience that it takes a programmer to make a program. We see that life requires a genetic program. Therefore, we have a strong basis for inferring that there was an intelligence responsible. This is what we know from uniform and repeated experience. The basis of all scientific reasoning is that whenever we see information and we trace it back to its ultimate source, whether we're looking at a section of computer code or a hieroglyphic inscription or a paragraph in a book, whenever we see information, and we always come back to an intelligent source, to a mind, not a material process. So this is the positive argument for intelligent design that I developed at some length in Darwin's Doubt.
Okay, one powerful argument against intelligent design and against a constantly improving or enriching form of life on Earth would be Al Gore. And Vice President Gore was on the Jimmy Kimmel show last night, and you will be shocked to hear that he was warning everyone who would listen about the true impact of climate change. Here's Al Gore.
But really, you know, we're putting 90 million tons of global warming pollution up there every day. And the cumulative amount, here's an image that I think is kind of hard to grasp, but it's true. The cumulative amount now traps more heat energy every day than would be released by 400,000 Hiroshima atomic bombs going off every day around the planet. It's a big planet, but that's a lot of energy. And that's what's raising the temperatures. Last year was the hottest year ever recorded in the U.S. We had the big drought, you know, all the fires, as I said. And things are getting to the point now where I think people are saying, whoa, wait a minute.
You want to try to fact check how many misstatements there are in that?
Well, just to start with, the other day, great article in the Wall Street Journal by Matt Ridley, a very prominent British scientist, now member of the House of Lords. We are putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. It's been about 100 billion tons of CO2 in the last 17 years during this period in which there has been no global warming.
Okay, so not 90 million tons
a day. 100 million tons, almost the same amount, over a course of about 17 years.
So he's misstating it about 100,000 to 1,
something like that. Yeah, I mean, you have to calculate how many days per year and times 17.
And what did he say, 400,000 Hiroshima bombs every day?
Don't breathe. I mean, it's just nuts. Yeah.
Where does he pull this stuff? David, do you have any questions? Because it's and you'll notice the audience is very solemn on the Jimmy Kimmel show. They're not. You think maybe he was trying to do stand up or something?
I don't know. He's got a great baritone voice. It sounds convincing when he says it, but those are just incorrect facts at every point. I mean, the really interesting thing about this is that you have this period of time where we have had no appreciable global warming. But the world economy is roughly doubled in that 17-year period, and so there is an increase of human-produced carbon dioxide, and yet there's been no appreciable warming, which is contrary to all the models that are predicting the huge increase in warming over the next century. So if the models don't explain the facts we already have well, how can we count on them to accurately predict the future?
Let's go to Jeff in Columbus, Ohio. Jeff, you're on the MedVed Show with Stephen Meyer and David Klinghoffer.
Well, hello, everyone. I've got a question about the designer, since you infer one or imply one. When did the designer act? How often does the designer act? And what do you think the end point of this action is?
Yeah, great question. I've written two books in which I have argued that design is the best explanation for events in the history of life. One concerns the origin of the very first life, getting the first living cell from simple non-living chemicals. That was my book, Signature in the Cell. And I'm convinced that an intelligent designer acted to help that process along. And the second book is about the origin of animal life. And so I'm, in print, arguing for design at those two points along the cosmic timeline. I'm also convinced that there is evidence of design from the very beginning of the universe, and something that physicists talk about called the fine-tuning of the laws and constants of physics.
We will be right back with more fine-tuning of arguments concerning Darwin's doubt. If you have some doubt or challenge to Stephen Meyer's basic argument so well and concisely put out here, you can give us a call.
Whoa, wait a minute.
1-800-955-1776. The Michael Medved Show. That's 1-800-955-1776. Show are brought to you in part by the Discovery Institute. To learn more, click on the Science and Culture banner at michaelmedved.com.
And I'm joined by Stephen Meyer, who is director of the Science and Culture Institute for Science and Culture of Discovery Institute, Center for Science and Culture of Discovery Institute. He is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Darwin's Doubt. He is also the author of the triumphal bestseller, Signature in the Cell. David Klinghoffer is the author of 6 books, including The Lord Will Gather Me In, his first book, critically acclaimed, and most recently, The Gift of Rest, a Rediscovering the Beauty of the Sabbath, co-authored with Senator Joe Lieberman. Let us go to your calls to Kent in Garland, Texas. You're on the Michael Medved Show with Stephen Meyer and David Klinghoffer of Discovery Institute.
Hi, gentlemen. I think that the whole concept of intelligent design has gigantic loopholes in it unless you concede that this designer is really some sort of god or supernatural creature, which I think is, isn't that what you all really believe?
It is what I believe, but I make a distinction in the book between what you can establish scientifically and what is left for further philosophical deliberation. Scientists use a principle of reasoning when they're reasoning about the remote past that's known as the vera causa principle. It was a principle that Darwin used. The idea is that when we're trying to explain an event in the remote past, we should be looking for causes that are known to have the power to produce the effect in question. If the key effect in question, the Cambrian explosion, is the information needed to build those animals, then that leads to a question. What is the cause that we know of from our uniform and repeated experience that can produce that kind of effect? We know of only one. It's mind or intelligence or conscious rational activity. So from the scientific evidence, we can infer that a mind of some kind played a role in the origin of the information needed to build those new animals, but we can't, from that evidence alone, determine that the mind was the mind of God. I think if you bring other evidence in, such as the evidence of the fine-tuning of the laws and constants of physics from the very beginning of the universe...
Hello, am I going to get to say something here?
Well, you asked a question.
Yeah.
Okay, all right, well, here we go.
Why don't you let me finish and then you ask your question?
Hello?
Why don't you let me finish and then you ask your question? Because you asked a question, I'm not quite done. I do think that the mind responsible is the mind of God, because I also see evidence of design from the very beginning of the universe in the fine-tuning of the laws and constants of physics. The universe itself, the fabric of the universe, shows evidence of design, and I don't think that's the kind of evidence that can be explained by any being within the cosmos, no space alien designer or something. So that's where I come down on it.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, okay, if you're going to come out and admit that we're really talking about creation here, then I think we're not really, we're almost out of the world of science and into faith. If you want to, and also,
if
you look at the bigger picture of what's going on this planet.
I just don't understand the connection you just made, Wes. Honestly, I want to give you credit here for participating in the conversation, but where did we leave the world of science?
Well, you're trying to prove the existence of God.
No, that's what I'm not trying to do. Emphatically not. You should read the book, because really there's no attempt to prove the existence of God. What there is an attempt to do is to suggest that the evidence overwhelmingly suggests that there was a designer. We don't know the identity of the designer, but that the universe is not the consequence of random forces, that it was consciously designed.
From the biological evidence alone, we can only infer a designer. There may be other evidence, and there may be other considerations that lead people to a theistic perspective. You asked me what my personal view was. I am a theist, But from the science of biology alone, what I argue for is a designing intelligence. So there's a distinction between the scientific evidence for intelligent design and the larger possible theistic or worldview implications.
Okay, so Wes, why is that a problem?
Here's the problem with the science. If you think the designers were not gods, who designed them?
Well, I agree. That's problematic. That's one of the philosophical reasons that I don't favor that view. But that goes beyond the argument I make in the book.
Point to consider here that if you're not talking about God, then your theory falls apart very quickly, and you ought to concede that.
Again, when you're talking about your theory, it's not a theory. It is a conclusion. In other words, and the conclusion is that the evidence, for instance, one of the difficulties here is that if you take a look at evidence of an explosion of new life forms that are incredibly complex and that all emerge in a very limited period of time, you have to ask yourself, how did that happen? And what you're trying to do is to shut off the question because you're afraid that the question might lead to a conclusion that there's a God. And to use that excuse to try to shut off a line of reasoning or investigation, it seems to me is totalitarian and disreputable. Certainly. We'll be right back. So Al Gore did have some brighter moments last night on Jimmy Kimmel. I mean, anything brighter than the 400,000 Hiroshima-sized bombs exploding every day in his mind. 1-800-955-1776, our phone number. This Science and Culture Hour from Discovery Institute before a wonderful live audience here. And by the way, I'm sorry for all those people who got turned away, actually, because we reached our capacity of sign-ups and then folks were discouraged. But we're glad that folks are here. People who do want to watch a live video streaming of this, and it's I've always resisted the idea of live video streaming of our show, but we're streaming live right now, and people can watch it at michaelmedved.com, or they can go to mynorthwest.com and see all the splendid realities. They can and see how well-dressed Stephen is.
David took off his tie.
David, okay, well, there you go. David took off his tie. 1-800-955-1776 is our phone number. Let's go to Monica in Chicago. You're on the MedVed Show with David Klinghoffer and Stephen Meyer.
So glad I made it through. Okay, I've got a question on a little bit of a different topic, but I would love if Dr. Meyer could comment on the current state of DNA research and how that relates to intelligent design versus evolution. Because from everything I've read, it seems like the more we learn about DNA, the farther away we're getting from Darwin's theory.
Very perceptive question. We're actually thinking of pulling together a little conference under the heading of the unexpected genome. There have been so many things discovered that have been unexpected from a Darwinian, materialistic, reductionist perspective. One just obvious example to point out is the discovery that the so-called junk DNA that was long thought to be the remnant of the Darwinian trial and error mutation selection process has turned out not to be junk at all, but the non-coding regions of the genome, the parts that don't code for building proteins, are nevertheless doing other important functions. And overall, these sections of the genome are functioning something like an operating system in a computer, which is directing the timing and controlling the expression of the coding files. And so a major unexpected thing, and also a prediction of the theory of intelligent design that is different than predictions made by Darwinism. The Darwinists thought that the non-coding regions were junk, and they thought that was expected on their theory because they thought that the mutation selection process would accumulate such errors over time. The ID people in the 1990s said, if our theory is true, we accept that there are mutations, but the mutation shouldn't be dwarfing the signal. We shouldn't have more noise than signal. And so ID scientists predicted that the non-coding regions of the genome would turn out to be functional, and so they have done.
Let's go to Dan in Eureka, California. Dan, you're on the MedVed Show with Stephen Meyer and David Klinghoffer.
Oh, hi, Stephen, Michael. I'm honored to be on your program. Michael, I've been a great fan for many years.
Thank you.
And Steve, I'm Dan from Eureka. We've actually met. I met you when I was studying for my PhD at University of Aberdeen, and we made a long drive down to see you at Cambridge.
Dan Price.
I'm honored to be on the program, and I've been working my way. I'm just a pastor, but I'm not a scientist, but I have an avid interest in this. My question for you is, I know you're familiar with Francis Collins, who's the great, you know, mapper of the human genome and a Christian. And in his book, The Language of God, he says, basically accuses ID of having a God in the gaps, God of the gaps theory. And I'm thinking, huh? How would you respond to that criticism?
And first explaining what God in the gaps means.
The God of the gaps idea is that the argument for intelligent design is an entirely negative argument. It's an argument based solely on the critique of Darwinian evolution and the inability of the mutation selection mechanism to build, for example, the information needed to generate these animals. But the accusation is that this is essentially what's known in logic as the informal fallacy of an argument from ignorance, where you're saying, well, cause A couldn't produce effect X, therefore cause B did it, without providing any positive evidence that cause B is capable of doing the job. But that's not how we're arguing. We're not saying Darwinian evolution is incapable of generating information, therefore it must have been intelligent design. The information needed to produce the animals must have been intelligently designed. Instead, we're arguing, yes, the neo-Darwinian mechanism does lack the capacity to produce these key effects, like the information needed to build life, but there is a cause of which we know that is capable of producing information. We have positive evidence that intelligent agency or agents are capable of generating digital code and other forms of information. Therefore, we can infer intelligent design as the best explanation.
If I can just jump in for a little bit, your last book, your previous book, Signature in the Cell, what we're talking about here is you're not saying, well, this document is unsigned, therefore it must be God. What you're saying is that there's a signature here, and the signature suggests intelligence.
Intelligence, based on our positive knowledge of the cause and effect structure of the world, not based on just a critique of Darwinism or a gap in our knowledge, but what we know affirmatively about what it takes to generate information, what we see generating information all the time.
In other words, it's affirmative evidence, not lack of evidence.
Exactly.
And I think that's a very important distinction. Let's go quickly to Paul in Woodinville, Washington. You're on the MedVed Show with Meyer and Klinghoffer.
Hello, gentlemen. Take it that you say that you're leaving the intelligent agency unnamed at this point or undefined. Is that correct, Mr. Mann?
Right. In the books that I've written, I'm inferring to an intelligent agent without attempting to define the identity of the designer from the evidence that I'm looking at.
Okay, because there are ways to figure that out, and so this is the question that I have for you, is that you're familiar with the relation of structure and function in biological design, for instance, that something that, for instance, that Darwin pointed out, that the structure of the various beaks of the various finches in the Galapagos Islands where speciation took place has to do with what the function was.
Paul, stay with us. We'll get back to that issue of function and design and maybe get back to not the God of the gaps, but the gore of the gaps coming up on the MedVed Show.
The greatest show on God's green earth.
Whoa, how gross and evil is that?
It's the Michael Medved Show.
Five minutes after the hour on the Michael Medved Show, a few minutes more with Stephen Meyer. Dr. Stephen Meyer is the director of the Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute here in Seattle. And my friend David Klinghoffer, who is a senior fellow at Discovery and is the editor and factotum for Evolution News and Views on the web. Let's go back to Paul in Woodinville. Paul, now we have very limited time. So you were talking about beaks and the Galapagos Islands and speciation and Darwin. If you can just zoom in on your point, then we'll get a response, okay?
The, structure of anything follows its function. It has to have its purpose first. Then, and you don't just invent a beak and then decide what it's good for. I think Mr. Mayor knows that. Okay, so my question, this is not a question, this isn't a gotcha question. So when you're identifying intelligent design, you're identifying the design, you're identifying the structure. So any design must have a purpose, a function. So when you identify this structure, you haven't told us, and if we can find out what the purpose is, maybe then we can name and identify the intelligent agency, because I can tell us what is the purpose of this structure that you identify as the design.
Well, one of the mysteries of modern biology is that biologists, though they are committed to a non-teleological, non-purposive interpretation of the origins of life, have found it almost impossible to describe biological systems without reference to the purpose that they perform, whether it's replication or proteins that foster the processing of information or replication. The language of purpose is infused in biology. I agree with you. I think that as a matter of second-order philosophical deliberation, it may be possible to come to a conclusion about the identity of the designer, but I don't attempt to make that argument in the books that I've written. I stay to a strictly scientific method that gets you to the conclusion that a mind of some kind was necessary. And I do think analyzing the individual purposes of individual biological systems is interesting. I'm not sure that will settle the question as to the identity of the designer, but certainly biology is suffused with the language of purpose these days.
Okay, Stephen and David, one of the things 100 years ago, atheists and agnostics would often talk about what they called the life force. If you want to talk about what is the purpose of these different systems developed in biology, the purpose, survival and procreation, is that a ridiculous notion?
Well, that's the Dawkins idea of the selfish gene. The gene has the purpose of replicating itself, but he kind of left out the other important part of biology, which is the organism, the actual animal that uses the genes. And we're finding that the reductionist view that says genes are the only thing that matters really isn't sufficient.
Stephen Meyer, author of Darwin's Doubt. You can read all about it. In fact, you can read it. You can actually order a copy at our website at michaelmedved.com. David Klinghoffer, the author most recently of The Gift of Rest, Rediscovering the Beauty of the Sabbath. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us and for everyone being here and support for Discovery Institute and This Greatest Nation on God's Green Earth.